evening, everyone. All right, we are going to talk tonight about something that is related to what the rest of the classes for the weekend are going to be about. If you're not going to be here for the rest of the weekend, totally fine, because this can actually totally stand alone. If you are going to be here, this will be good sort of background information to what we're going to talk about in tomorrow's classes and Sunday, because we're going to talk about Gideon, which is an awesome, awesome study. He's such a relatable character in the Bible to talk about. Before we get to that, though, Gideon is in the book of Judges, right? Who knows how many judges there are in the book of Judges? Any guesses?
17.
Good guess. Too many. 12. Excellent guess. There are 12 judges in the book of Judges. Was that Benny? Did you say that, Benny? Yeah. Benny came into my office the other day and saw my notes sitting on my desk, and he just started reading them, and he was like, oh, I'm going to remember the answers to all these questions. And I said, if you do, I'm just going to embarrass you in front of everyone. So now we've both made good on our promises. Yes, there are 12 judges in the book of Judges. Now, Bene, no. Does anybody know all the judges in the book of Judges? I will be really impressed if anybody does. I cannot even remember all the judges in the book of Judges, and I know a little special mnemonic that I remember. I think I still remember it. Years ago. You know where you take like the first letter of each word and then you make a silly phrase? Yeah. One elephant does something good to just jump in everywhere and somewhere. Means nothing, right? It doesn't even make any sense. But I still remember it. One elephant does something good to just jump in everywhere and somewhere. So 5 minutes ago, I was like, let's see if ChatGPT can give me something more memorable than that. And it gave me something, and I was like, nope, not any more memorable than mine. So ready for this? 12 judges. One elephant does something good to just jump in everywhere and somewhere. Now, the problem with that is that I know the first letter to all the judges, but I still cannot remember some of them, like Ibzan, Elon, and Abdon. You might remember some like Gideon, Samson, Ehud. Remember, he was the guy that was left-handed, and he like shoved the dagger so far into Eglon's belly that it disappeared. Like, so the judges are a super exciting period of the Bible. But sadly, the judges are also a period in the Bible when most people didn't believe in God. But that also makes it kind of relatable to us. Now, the question is, what really big Bible character came right before the book of Judges? So think in your mind. You can even just like say the books of the Bible in your mind if you remember that far. Yes, who was it?
Joshua.
Joshua was a super faithful leader. And right after Joshua dies, not very long after, we have this period of the Judges where everybody's just gone off the rails and they've become really wicked. And the question is, well, how do you get to that point? How does it go so quickly from Joshua to a period of time where for over 400 years, people really largely didn't believe in God at all? So, I'm going to give you a task. I'm going to give you 2 minutes to do it. Here's your question. How does someone become comfortable with something they know is wrong? Okay? How does someone become comfortable with something they know is wrong? Now, you don't have to get really personal and like think about something in your own life that like, well, I know how I did that and that, but I don't really want to talk. Now, I'm not looking for, this is not like a personal sharing session. We're going to talk in principle. So before I get you to tell me, you can talk amongst yourself, talk to your neighbor, talk to the people at your table. Probably too big to talk as like a whole group, but talk as loud as you want. 2 minutes. See if you can come up with some ways that you get comfortable with something that you know is not the right thing to do, and yet we find ourselves getting comfortable doing it. Does that make sense? Question clear enough? Awesome. 2 minutes. Go. Okay. Was everybody able to come up with at least one thing?
Yep.
If you weren't, that's fine. Sorry to cut you off early, but we got other stuff to talk about. So, is anybody willing to volunteer? Now, again, I don't want to get personal, and especially if this is like, don't start your sentence with, well, my sibling got comfortable with something that they shouldn't have, right? We don't need to get, you know, that deep here. Yes, Zara.
Repetition is great teaching device.
Repetition is a great teaching device. Did somebody whose name starts with a B come up with that in your group? Yeah.
Yes.
So give me an example. What do you mean? Can you elaborate? Can you elaborate on that? Thank you, Boaz. Yes. You know what's actually really, really, that's the scary side of it. The really positive side of that is that actually if you do the same thing over and over and over again and it's a good thing, that it can actually form a good habit. But it goes both ways, right? That's a fantastic example. What else? Yes.
Like thinking of somebody else who's also doing something bad. And, well, that person's also doing something bad, so like I can do something.
Yes, that's one of the many ways, that's a word that starts with J, that we can justify things, right? Like, I've seen Ethan do it, so I didn't think that was a good thing to do, but Ethan does it. I have a lot of respect for Ethan. Ethan seems like a really cool person, and she's really spiritual, and she does it. So I can do it too, right? Lots of different ways we can justify. Yes, different group. I'll come back to you guys, but a different group. Any other groups come up with something different? Micah?
Everybody else is doing something that you
should be. Did anybody's parents say that to them? Like when you're like, well, everybody else gets to do this. Did anybody's parents say, if everybody else jumped off a bridge, would you jump off the bridge too? Yes. But yeah.
I think a lot, you know, like Jesus, like is gonna, like he'll forgive me.
Yeah.
But like when we consciously do something like that, it just contradicts it.
Yeah, and that can be so damaging, right? Because then that just gets us completely mixed up with like, well, is that how God views forgiveness? That you can be like, God, I know this is wrong, but it's going to be a lot of fun. And I really want to do it. So can you forgive me in advance? Because if not, then I'll ask. It sounds silly, but that's exactly what our natural mind kind of does sometimes, right? Like we know something's wrong, but I just really want to do it. Sorry, I just really want to do it. I guess I'll ask for forgiveness later. Or maybe we don't even think about asking for forgiveness in that moment, but afterwards we do, because we're like, oh, now I've done it. Shouldn't have done it. So yeah, the excitement of doing the wrong thing sometimes is just too great. Yeah?
Like normalizing it, like kind of like, yeah, I don't know, just like normalizing it, like, oh, it's fine, it's just one little thing or something.
Yeah, we almost like play down how bad it is, right? Either because we're not going to do it that often, or really it's not as bad as I thought it was. Really what we mean is, it's not as bad, well, I don't want it to be as bad as it is, so I'll pretend that it's not, right? So there's all these different ways that we can become comfortable with doing something that we know is wrong. Now, do you know what the really interesting thing is that it's been like that since the beginning of creation. So turn in your Bibles, if you have one, to the book of Judges. We're going to go to Judges chapter 1, because this is one of the ways how after having such a godly leader like Joshua, so quickly the nation of Israel became like they did in the book of Judges, where it says that everybody just did whatever they wanted. They did what was right in their own eyes. So, Judges chapter 1, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, Joshua, Judges. What is that? Seventh book, so near the beginning. Judges chapter 1. Now, I want you to look in verse... So, what Judges 1 is about is that the children of Israel have just finally come into the promised land. Okay, Moses brought them out of Egypt. They crossed the Red Sea. They wandered in the wilderness for 40 years. Joshua then led them into the promised land. He brings them into the land and he says, okay, 12 tribes, it's your job now to take over the land. God's given you the responsibility to go in and drive out the inhabitants of the land because God said, this is your land. Actually, God said, this is my land that I'm going to give to you. So you need to go in and drive out the ungodly nations that live there. And that's what Judges 1 is about. But look what happens. In Judges 1, look in verse 21. Okay, Benjamin, one of the tribes. Do you see what it says in verse 21? The children of Benjamin did not drive out the Jebusites that inhabited Jerusalem. They just let the Jebusites live in Jerusalem with them. You see what it says in verse 27? Neither did Manasseh drive out the inhabitants of Beth Shean and her towns or all these other towns. So Benjamin and Manasseh have not gone in and driven out the ungodly people that they were supposed to. Look in verse 29. Neither did Ephraim drive out the Canaanites. And this is where you're like, oh, if I'm ever going to remember this again in the future, it would be helpful to maybe circle this or something in my Bible, because there's a pattern that's developing here. And that's a super useful thing to do with a Bible marking, with just like a pencil or a coloring pencil. So I've colored them. Do you know how I'm finding these so easy? Because I've colored them in red in my Bible. So verse 30, neither did Zebulun drive out the inhabitants of its areas. Neither did, verse 31, neither did Asher. And you know what? You can go through and you see over and over again when the people were supposed to go in and drive out all these ungodly people, this tribe didn't, that tribe didn't. And then like somebody said, when you look over, let's say you're in like, we're all in the tribe of Naphtali together, and we're like, oh, you know what I heard? I heard that Benjamin didn't even, like, that's a lot of work to drive all those people out. I heard Benjamin didn't even bother. They just let the people live with them. And we're all like, yeah, you know what? We could sleep in tomorrow if we don't have to get up and do that. This would be way less work. And I heard that Asher didn't do it either. Oh, really? Two of the tribes didn't? Yeah, and I heard that Issachar didn't either. And I heard that Judah's tribe didn't either. And before you know it, the pattern in Judges 1 is that nobody's doing what they're supposed to, because it's just easier. You've been wandering in the wilderness for all these years. You haven't had any of the creature comforts that you want. And now you're finally in the land. You can finally build your own house. You can get your own animals. You can set up your own pickleball court. Do whatever you want in the land. Or you could go drive out all these people and spend all your days doing that. Which one are you going to pick? Well, the flesh, when it gets comfortable, well, it just wants to be lazy, right? Anybody else's natural self lazy like mine is? Absolutely it is, right? And do you know what God ends up teaching them? Well, actually, they learn by their own experience, is the problem was not that they couldn't defeat their enemies in the land. The problem was that they became willing to live alongside people that they never should have lived alongside. It's kind of like the answer to that question we talked about. How do you get comfortable with something that's wrong when you know it's wrong? You just give it a little bit of space in your life. You just do it once. I've done it once and nothing bad happened. Maybe I'll do it a second time. And before you know it, you go down the track and you get comfortable with it. Now, do you know what God says about that? What's God? So we can get comfortable with, let's just call it sin. I'll just use a simple word to define it. We can get comfortable with some sort of sin, whether it's a thought or an action. And we can convince ourselves that, you know, it's not that big a deal. Do you know what God says sin is from his perspective? It's like this. Yeah. And when we go back to sin, when we do a sin, and then we're like, oh, that was really bad. I shouldn't have done that. And maybe we ask God for forgiveness. But then we go back to it again. God says that's like a dog that vomits and then goes back to that vomit to eat it. Yeah, that's how the Bible describes it. And yet we forget that in the moment, right? We think that vomit looks so appealing. Now, we would never say that. Nobody would ever say. I don't think in any culture, anywhere in the world, would somebody say that vomit looks delicious and appealing. And yet the Bible describes it as something that's what our natural self wants to do. It wants to go back to this thing that God says is horrid and disgusting. Right? That's our difficult reality. That's our experience with sin. The good news is that God doesn't want to leave us in that place. God wants to forgive us and to save us, even when we've committed sins. There's so many passages in the Bible. These are just a few. I'll just put, and we're not going to turn to these ones. There's so many passages in the Bible that says even when you've made big mistakes, even if you've made the same mistake over and over again, like the children of Israel do in the days of the judges, God wants to forgive if we come to him and we repent of that sin. Do you know, even if you've repented of a sin before and then you go do that sin again, you can still ask for repentance again for that same sin, and God still wants to forgive you for it. Now, that's sort of a different topic we can talk about separately, but God is still prepared to forgive us even when we've done the wrong thing more than once, more than twice, more than 50 times. That doesn't mean that we can just go do it and say, well, God will forgive me. Not a big deal. No, that's not how God views repentance. But he is willing to forgive us if we come to him with the right spirit. And that's what pretty much the whole book of Judges is about. It's about people who continually do the wrong thing. God punishes them because of it. They cry out to God, and then God sends them someone to save them, right? That's the cycle of the book of Judges, and it's actually kind of the cycle of our lives. Now, come to, where do we want to go next? Give me a quick second. Let's go to, actually just turn over one page, or maybe you don't even have to turn a page, the Judges chapter 2, okay? Look in Judges chapter 2. Does anybody want to read nice and loud verse 11 and 12? Two verses. Judges, sure, I'll start with Eden. Maybe we'll just, I'll take volunteers around the table. We're going to have a few different verses to read. So, Eden, do you want to read verse, actually, can you read verse 11? And then you can read verse 12. Is that all right? Awesome.
Then the children of Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord and served the Baals. And they forsook the Lord God of their fathers, which brought them out of the land of Egypt, and followed other gods of the gods of the people that were round about them, and bowed themselves unto them, and provoked the Lord to anger.
Okay, so the people forsook God and ended up serving the gods of the nations. Now look what it says. Scan your eyes down a few verses. I'm going to put it on the screen too. In verse 20. Okay? We're not going to read all of that, but I just want you to notice, here it is. I want you to notice this phrase in the middle of Judges 2 verse, when we get down to verse 20 and 21 and 22. God says, I will not henceforth drive out any, he's talking about the nations that they were supposed to drive out, any from before them, which Joshua left when he died, so that through them I may prove Israel. You know, God won't do for you what he hasn't asked you to participate in doing yourself. God won't just do for you what he's asked you to participate in doing for yourself. And what I mean by that is, you can't just wake up and think that God's just going to do everything for you all day long. God needs us to be involved in our discipleship. He needs us to participate in doing the right thing, and he'll do his part to help us along the way. There's a, some of you will have heard of this book called Ways of Providence. Anybody heard of that book that Uncle Robert Roberts wrote? Well, such a good book. It's the first book I ever read after I got baptized. Highly recommend it. Okay? It's not a difficult book to read. You might hear the name, I didn't even put it on the screen. I shouldn't have told you who wrote it. Uncle Robert Roberts. Don't be scared by that. It's a really easy book to read. Very powerful. It's basically all about how God works through in invisible ways in the lives of his servants. And this is what Uncle Robert Roberts said. He says, God requires men to do their part as the condition and means of enabling him to work out his purpose with and concerning them. Now that's probably one of the most complicated sentences in the book. So if you understand even part of that, you are in good shape to understand the whole book. Basically what he's saying is, God needs you to do something, right? He can't do it all for you. He needs your involvement, because that's how he works. He doesn't just do everything for us. That's not how God operates. Now, let's talk about, because we have two things we're going to talk about for the rest of the time. First one is Midian, and the second one is Manasseh. Now, why are we talking about Midian? And the answer is because Midian, remember how we talked about in the book of Judges, there's this cycle of like the people do something wrong and then God sends a nation against them to punish them because of the sins that they're committing. Midian is the people that God brought against Israel in the time of Gideon. So we need to quickly review what we know about Midian in the Bible. I'll put a couple things on the screen to give you some examples. Does anybody remember, this is not a super easy question, does anybody remember who Midian descended from? Like way, way back, he descended from a super famous person. In the Bible, not super famous like, you know, you think of famous people today and you're like, Donald Trump is famous. Midian descended from Abraham. Yeah. He was a descendant of Abraham, like the faithful Abraham. And remember, Abraham had another son whose name was, sorry, not another son. Abraham had two sons, one through Hagar, whose name was Ishmael. That's where Midian comes from. He had another son. Who's the more famous son of Abraham that we remember? The one that was offered on an altar, almost offered on an altar. Isaac, I see Micah is mouthing it. Now, Abraham sends his descendants, the descendants that will become Midian, off to east of where he's living, because he wants to create separation from his chosen son, Isaac. We know from the story of Genesis, do you remember when Joseph was thrown in a pit and some traders came along and then his brothers sold him off to some traders? Those were Ishmaelite traders, and Ishmaelites are related to the Midianites. Okay? Moses went to the land of Midian. He actually married a Midianite woman, and this woman who came from what was like part of the ungodly people of the land, she joined herself to Moses. But then there was an incident in the book of Numbers when the people of Midian and the nations around Israel, as they're getting closer to entering the promised land, all the nations around the promised land were like, guys, we got to do something about this. Because there's this people who worship a God called Yahweh, and they're going to come and they're going to kick us all out of our homes and out of the land, because that's what Yahweh told them to do, because he said it's his land. So we need to find a way to defeat them. Does anybody have any ideas? And a guy named Balak stands up and he's like, well, I'll go up and, you know, get a guy named Balaam and he can help me throw curses at them. Which is totally unsuccessful. Obviously it doesn't work to curse God's people if God doesn't want them to be cursed. So Balak comes up with this great idea. He says, I know what we'll do. This is like a really spooky story. Balak comes up with this idea. He's like, we'll take super ungodly women and send them in amongst all the men of Israel and convince them all to spend time together and do inappropriate things together, and that will corrupt all of their good principles, and God will be angry with them and he will slay many of them. And you know what? It works amazingly. Balak's plan to corrupt many of the people of Israel, and God ends up very angry with many of the people of Israel. And you know what it says? It says that that incident, which was at a place called Baal Peor, it was first and foremost a woman of Midian who was doing horrible things right at the gate of the tabernacle where people were supposed to be worshiping God. And God gets very angry. He slays thousands, tens of thousands of the people because of this horrible sin that they are starting to commit. And that started with a woman from Midian, until a man named Phinehas comes and gets involved and he slays them, and he ends up slaying a bunch of the Midianites because God is not just angry with his people, he's angry with the Midianites. Okay, so Midian does not have a good history with Israel. They're like super enemies. In fact, the last thing that God tells Moses before he dies, he says, Moses, I have one last thing I need you to do. Do you know what it is? I need you to blot out the Midianites. I need you to get rid of all of them because they're just going to corrupt my people. That's the last thing that God tells Moses to do before he dies. However, they don't go kill all the Midianites. They keep some of them alive. And over the course of enough time, what happens when you have a problem in your life, like a sin that you're struggling with, and you sort of kind of cut it off, but not really? Give it enough time, and that bad habit that you tried to kick, what happens to bad habits when we don't totally get rid of them? Bad habits find a way back into our life, right? It was the same thing with the Midianites. They found a way to grow in number again so that by the time Gideon comes along 200 or so years later, there's not just a few Midianites. We're going to see in the classes tomorrow, there is what the Bible calls a host of Midianites. Hundreds of thousands of Midianites that come against him. Now, let's jump forward and talk about Manasseh, okay? So that's Midian. Midian is like the enemy in this story. The Bible is full of enemies of God's people, but Midian is the enemy in the story of Gideon. Now, do you remember that incident we just talked about? I'm going to put something on the screen that's going to make you immediately fall asleep. Ready? Okay, not really. But it's going to immediately make you go, I wish I was asleep. Because that's a lot of numbers. Stick with me for a second here, okay? Remember the story we just talked about where Balak had that idea where, hey, if we can get the women to go and do inappropriate things with the men, that God will get angry with the people and God will slay a whole bunch of the people? The Bible records a lot of that in a lot of detail. And one of the cool things that it records, that when you read it in the Bible, you're like, this is kind of boring. Like, what? Did we spend a whole chapter talking about this? What it does is in the book of Numbers in chapter 1, it goes through tribe by tribe of all 12 tribes of Israel and says, here's how many people were in the tribe. And you get to the end of Numbers 1 and you're like, so what? Right? That's what our natural mind thinks. But then there's that other part of your brain that's like, but this is God's word. So there's got to be some really good reason. Because God doesn't just write chapters in the Bible just to fill space. He was not about like, you know what, I need this book to be the longest book that anybody's ever written. That's not why there's so many chapters in the Bible. And that's not why Numbers chapter 1 was written. It's because when you... Okay, who are my readers in the room? Who loves to read books? Don't be afraid to admit it. My kids are all readers. I am not. So if you're not a reader, don't try to pretend and lie like, oh, I'm a reader. I'm not a reader, so you can keep your hand down here with me. Who's a reader? Okay, I know, even without being a reader, that the makings of a really good book, at least my kids tell me, is that when you read something, and then way later in the book, maybe not even in that book, in a subsequent book, like in the sequel, or the sequel of the sequel, something way earlier on, all of a sudden becomes super important. And you're like, I gotta go back and read that first part of the book now so that I can read the whole rest of it and know what's coming, right? Now, those of you that are not readers like me, you're like, still boring. Okay? I'm right there with you. But this is what Numbers 1 is. Because when you get to 26 chapters later, the Bible does it all over again. And it tells you how many people were in each tribe again. And the difference is that incident that we talked about with Balak happens in between. And when you look at what happened to the number of people in each tribe before and the number of people in each tribe afterwards, something really interesting jumps out of the Bible. Okay? And here's what's really interesting that jumps out. Now, I've put like the change in all those ones. You can see like Benjamin went up by 10,000 people. Reuben like lost 2,000. Oh, Naphtali lost like 8,000 people. Do you know how many people the tribe of Simeon lost? By the way, the woman who was from Midian doing that inappropriate thing at the tabernacle, she was doing it with a man from the tribe of Simeon, which suggests that the people of Simeon were more heavily involved than others. We don't know for sure, but watch this. Guess how many people the tribe of Simeon lost? 37,000. More than four times more than almost five times as much as any other tribe lost. Simeon lost way more. But we're not talking about Simeon. We're talking about Manasseh. Guess what happened in Manasseh? The exact opposite. The tribe of Manasseh went up by almost twice as much as anybody else. Now, what does that have to do with anything? You might ask. I'm so glad you asked. Here's what I think the Bible's telling us, is that tribes like Simeon, which we know, not just because their number went down. If we took the time to look at it, we could prove that Simeon was more involved than other tribes in that horrible incident. But if Manasseh went up by almost twice as much, that would also suggest that maybe they were not as involved in that incident. Now, the reason we know, one of the reasons we know that is because Moses says at the end of Numbers 26, he says to Joshua, when you get into the land and you're dividing up the land to all the people, give more land to people who have more people and less land to people who have less people. And do you know what happens when they get in the land? Look at this. When you look at this map that shows you with different colors and like the things around it, what do you notice about the tribe of Manasseh? Right off the bat. They're huge. Way bigger than any other tribe. Now, is that because they had the most people? Well, they had 52,000, but look at like Issachar. Issachar wins, actually. They have 64,000 in Numbers 26. Look at how small Issachar's area is. But wait a minute, I thought we were supposed to give more land to tribes that had more people. So why did Manasseh get such a huge area? And you know what? The Bible gives us the answer. This is like one of those great books, which I don't know anything about because I'm not a reader. But when you read carefully, the Bible actually answers the question. Why does Manasseh have a huge area? And they actually have two areas because the Jordan River runs down the middle of this. So they have a huge area over here and another huge area over here. Boaz, do you have the answer or a question?
No, I just wanted to
jump in. Yeah, go ahead.
More
land? Oh, more numbers back here. Oh, you're right, two. Yeah, I missed that one. Thank you. 76,000. Judah has the most. Is that what you're pointing out? Yep. Awesome. Good observation. You like numbers, don't you? Uh-huh. Yeah, there's my fellow, anybody else a math nerd in here like me? And Boaz? Yeah, don't be afraid to admit it. We might not like books, or maybe you do, but we like math. So, why does Manasseh have such a huge area? Okay, they have two huge portions. And what you can't tell from the map is that if you could see the area of Israel at the time, actually, these two areas right here that I've just circled in blue are beautiful, lush valleys, like some of the best farming land in all of Israel. This is what those areas look like. Bashan and the Valley of Jezreel. They are gorgeous farming properties, probably even way better back then when there was more water in the area, and now the land is becoming drier and drier. Different topic we can talk about. But those two areas were included in Manasseh's territory. Now, why did Manasseh get two big portions, these beautiful areas of the valley? And the short answer is, here's the last place we're going to turn to, come to Numbers. You guys have done amazing. We're near the end. Come to Numbers 32. Because this answers for us why Manasseh had two big portions, well, why it had two portions, why they were huge, and why they had some of the best area. Okay, before we look at Numbers 32, did you know that actually God had said when they came into the land, everybody was supposed to have huge portions? That the territory of Israel was supposed to go all the way from the Mediterranean Sea. How far over here? Who's good with geography? What's way over here on the map? Like over on the wall. He said, you're supposed to have the land from the sea to
Euphrates,
right? The river Euphrates is like way over there. Maybe even outside. Okay? Like way out there. Can you see where my pointer is? Way out there? What's out there? Is that where Simon Manor is? No, that's somewhere else. Huge. They were supposed to have a huge area, but they didn't. Why not? Because what we saw in Judges 1, right? They neither did Benjamin drive out, neither did Naphtali. They didn't drive out the nations they were supposed to. But Manasseh did better than others. And here's the proof in Numbers 32. You ready? This is cool. This is exciting because this introduces Gideon to the story, even though Gideon's name isn't mentioned here. Look in Numbers 32. Who wants to read next? Not everybody has to read, so I'll go around the circle, and if you want to read, you can get to, I got to Micah. Awesome. We're going to get to Numbers 32. Look at verse 34. And Micah, if you ever get to a name, anybody, free pass. If you get to a name that you don't know how to say, just throw something out there and do your best, because, you know, there's some fun names here. So just verse 34, Micah.
And the children of Gad built Dibon and Ataroth and Aroer.
Excellent. Now, here's the word I actually want you to focus on. It's a word that you all know, okay? The children of Gad built these cities called Dibon and Ataroth and Aroer, and if we kept reading, they built Ataroth and Shophan and Jazer and Jogbeha, okay? They built. That's the significant word. Why is that significant? Well, because look what it says in verse 37. Who wants to read the next one? Yep, go ahead, boys.
Verse 37,
yep.
Verse 32?
Yep, same chapter, just a few verses later. Excellent. Guess what the most important word in that verse is? Built. Okay? Now, you might think, well, why are we making a big deal out of that? Because look what it says when we get to verse 39 about Manasseh. The children of Manasseh, the children of Maker, the son of Manasseh, went to Gilead. You see, it doesn't say they built Gilead. They went to a city that was already there, and they took it. That's what God had told them to do. God didn't say, move into the land and build cities. He said, move into the land and drive out the ungodly inhabitants. And Manasseh is the first tribe that it says did that in the book of Numbers. They went to Gilead, and they took it. Look what it says in the next and the rest of the verse. And dispossessed the Amorite. Oh, that's such a good word, but nobody uses that word anymore. Does anybody have a different translation that doesn't say dispossessed the Amorite? Somebody's got to have something. Look in verse 39. We're nearly done. You're doing amazing. After it says they took it, what does it say instead of dispossessed to the Amorite? Does everybody say dispossessed? No. Okay, here's your homework. Go home and look up the word dispossessed. And come back tomorrow and tell me what it means, because, ooh, that's a powerful word. Dispossessed. But we'll talk about that tomorrow. They dispossessed the Amorite. Okay? Now, you might think, well, you're kind of making a big deal out of that. But look what it says in verse 41. It says it again. And Jair, the son of Manasseh, went and took the small towns. Look what it says in verse 42. And Noba, who is another man of Manasseh, went and took Kenath. Do you see what the Manassites do? Is that what we call them? Manassites? The people of Manasseh? They don't go in and build cities. They go in and they take them away from the ungodly people because that's what God told them to do. And actually, you know what we find out is we find out that the people of Manasseh, they were more interested than any other tribe in taking the land from the Euphrates all the way to the Mediterranean. That's what drove Manasseh. In fact, the Bible describes them, if we looked in Joshua 17, it describes them as men of war. They were passionate and zealous about doing exactly what God said, which was go in, drive out the land, take the cities. Don't build your own, take the cities. And that's what they did. Now, what does all this have to do with Gideon? Okay, because this is what sets Gideon up. And here's where the penny drops. Manasseh had a son who we just read about. His name was Maker. So Manasseh is Maker's father. Maker had a son. I would not expect anybody to know this. I don't have a funny expression to memorize these ones, not like the one about old elephants. Maker had a son named Gilead. Gilead had a son named Abiezer. And Abiezer had a son named Joash, and Joash had a son whose name was Gideon. Do you see the point? Gideon came from a tribe of people who, more than any other tribe in Israel, did what God wanted them to in driving people out and taking huge portions of the land that God had promised for them to inherit. Gideon came from a tribe of people who were full of people that were described as men of war. Gideon had a heritage of like men who were like men's men and would go out into battle. And do you know why that's really powerful? Because that's not the type of person Gideon was. And you might think, what? I thought the whole point of this was to talk about how Gideon was going to be just like, what would this be? Dad, grandpa, great-grandpa, great-great-grandpa Maker. Oh, that's not the type of person Gideon was. So here's our takeaway points for tonight. And if you're disappointed about that, well, come tomorrow. Because we're going to find out that even though Gideon didn't start that way, God got him there. That's one of the best lessons of Gideon's life. So here's our takeaway points from tonight. Don't become so comfortable with sin, whatever that sin, whatever that temptation is, whatever that thing in your house is, whatever that thing at the mall, whatever that thing is that you know you shouldn't be comfortable with, don't become so comfortable with it that you stop wanting it gone. Don't let go of that part of your conscience that says, this is wrong, I shouldn't do this. Yes, we might give into that temptation, which is not okay. But don't ever stop knowing that it's wrong. And we have to try to stop doing it. Oh, sorry, I didn't put it on the screen. Oh, don't become so comfortable with sin that you stop wanting it gone. Here's the second one, just 2 points tonight, okay? You can have a strong heritage. You might think like, oh yeah, I come from my grandpa, he was a really upstanding man, and his grandpa was a really upstanding man, and you know, I come from a long line of strong, upstanding men or women or whatever. My grandma was known for this in her town, or you might not. It actually doesn't matter to God what your background is and what you come from, because even if you feel like, oh, I come from a situation where like my family's a mess, no, our siblings don't get along, my parents don't get along, their parents didn't get along, their parents didn't. That is not a problem for God. Not a problem at all. And the proof is Gideon. And we're going to talk more about that tomorrow. Okay? You've been awesome. I know it's getting on late. Thanks for your attention. Oh, I forgot to do... Can we do a quick activity?
Yes, please.
Super quick. Okay? Oh, I forgot to do this in the middle. Okay? This activity is about blind spots. Okay? Maybe you've done this before. If you have, bear with me. Pretend you haven't. Just humor me. Okay? I'm going to pass... Everybody needs one of these. Okay? Try to make this fast. Oh, because you've been a very patient audience. Did you know? Of course you did, because you guys are smart. You're not like fourth graders. You just need one. You just need one. There's way more than I needed. I printed off like 60, and Ann had asked and said, did you forget that, like, not like all of Western Canada is coming to CYC tonight. So you just need one, okay? Raise your hand if you have done this before. Okay, a few of you have. It's pretty cool, though, isn't it? Like, I just did it. I've done this many times before, and I did it again yesterday. It was like, whoa, this is so weird. What you're going to do is take it and put it in front of you. I got to make sure I give good instructions. Last time I did this, I gave the wrong instructions, and it didn't work. Okay, put the dot on the right-hand side, okay? Dot on that side. If you struggle with your rights and lefts, that side is right. Make it so the dot's over there. X is on the other side. You're going to put it as far away as your hand is from you, and you're going to cover one eye, okay? If you cover, actually, let's just all cover the same eye. Let's cover your left eye. I have to make sure I'm doing this right. Oh, boy. Maybe I'm going to cover my right eye. If you've done this before, you know what we're doing. Yeah, there it is. Okay, here's what we're going to do. Oh, should have wrote this down. So cover your right eye. Hold it in your left hand as far away as it goes. Slowly, like sort of right in front of you, look with your left eye, right? Because you've got your right eye covered. This is important. You need to cover your right eye, and you're going to look at the dot. Bring it closer towards you, slowly, and eventually, the X disappears. It's probably pretty close to your face. Like, it's within, like, probably a foot of your face. So, cover your right eye, look at the dot, move it closer. Don't cheat, don't be looking over at the, just try to, I know it's hard, you're like, but I want to look at the X.
Okay?
Call your doctor. There's a good optometrist on the road. Okay? If you struggled with it and you couldn't get it working, you can play around with it more afterwards. I can show you how to do it. But it works. The point is, everybody has a blind spot. And you know what? You could do the same thing with your other eye. We actually have a blind spot in both eyes. Now, here's the scary thing. Did you know, when you get to that point and you can't see the X anymore, if you got to that point, what does your eye naturally want to do? You're like, whoa, is the X gone? And so you look at the X, right? You know the X is there, even though you can't see it. Your brain knows the X is there. Because what your brain is doing is it's filling in what it can't see. And you know what? Our mind tries to do that too. That's how we convince ourselves to become comfortable with something that we shouldn't. That's how we end up with blind spots. And when we have a spiritual blind spot, we have something in our life that we've become too comfortable with, and we just can't see that it's wrong, what do we need in that moment? We need somebody to come along and be like, hey, Uncle Tim, I think you might have a blind spot here. Right? And what does my brain want to do when they say that? I'm like, no, I don't. Who do you think you are? Right? But we need each other to help us see when we have those blind spots, to say, hey, look, it's a blind spot. By nature of the fact that you're blind to it, I wouldn't expect that you can see it. You're just going to have to trust me. That's the value of good friends. So, make sense? Oh, I forgot to do that in the middle, but that's what happened. I think that's one of the things that happened with Israel. They got comfortable. They had this blind spot, didn't realize it, and things just went south. So, everybody has blind spots. We all need each other to help each other see them. Thanks for humoring me and doing that activity.